Thank you all for coming tonight. This is my first PowerPoint presentation, so I've gone through it. I'm confident everything's going to work well, but it isn't quite maybe the way I would have liked it, but it's my first attempt at this, and I certainly give thanks to my wife, Beth, because it wouldn't be as nice as it is without a lot of her help, and Joel and Jenny for helping me with getting set up on the projector, and although I don't see them here tonight, for some input that I got from my brothers Don and Jay as well as Gordon. Tonight, I don't want you to come with any big hopes that aren't going to be realized. This isn't going to be anything revolutionary. It's just some information I found interesting. It's going to be mostly a little bit of a history lesson. This Friday is going to be the bicentennial anniversary of what was a very important event in history, and that I think has significance in what was at the time biblical prophecy, and now, of course, having passed is now history, and helps us to kind of look towards what we can expect in the future, I hope. It's kind of like when we're in our Sunday school class, sometimes we talk about an event that says, you know, the Assyrians came in and they conquered and carried off this section, or the Babylonians came into this, and we kind of lump it together. Well, there are a lot of events that occurred during that over a period of time. So tonight, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to look at one event that in itself, you know, prophecy doesn't specifically address, but it's a significant event that the consequences and the things occurred from it, I believe that we can find recorded in Scripture and indicated. And so tonight's basically going to be, for the most part, going to be a history lesson. I certainly could use other events to make the same points, but I've picked this because of the significance that Friday is going to be 200 years from the date of this event. And then after we go through that, we're going to take a little time, look at some scriptures, and see how that fits in there tonight. I have entitled this presentation this evening, Ephraim, the Mighty Man. But it's really going to be a history lesson about a famous naval battle that involved the British Navy. In the past, it's not anything new. In the past, in some discussions, you know, we have considered the possibility that the English-speaking nations, and primarily Britain, may very well be of the tribe of Ephraim, the descendants that have come down from that. And we're going to, so keep that in mind as we go through this tonight, that I'm going on that that belief. There's some compelling evidence to indicate that that may be the case. And so believing that, if I take some look at the history and I try to fit those things in, I should see where it fits in biblical prophecy, and I believe that is the case. And so that's what we're going to spend some time at looking here tonight. As I said, Friday the 21st is going to be the bicentennial anniversary of a significant naval battle, and that occurred Friday. Or not Friday, it was Friday, but October 21st, 1805. And that was the battle, it's called, referred to as the Battle of Trafalgar, because that's where it was fought off the coast of a location known as Trafalgar, off along the Spanish coast. And it was where the British naval fleet defeated a much larger combined French and Spanish fleet. This particular battle is significant that it really changed the history of the world, and it's really secured the British Empire from that time forward. It's just one of a many series of events, but it was a crucial. It's a crucial time in history. If you look at it, 1805 is just prior to the restoration of the gospel, and I think when we look at some of the events that are happening in that time, that there are great significance. As I said, you know, there's really no specific prophecy that's going to look at this tonight. But as we go through this, I want to bring to our attention some very significant things, I think. I'm going to spend some time looking at what happened here, because I don't believe it was just chance. I don't believe that it was just luck. And as we go through here, I believe that there was one particular man who was raised up to accomplish what happened that day. To really kind of understand what leads into this, we really have to kind of understand the setting. Just prior to this, we've had the American Revolution, the birth of this nation. Following that, kind of inspired by this new fledgling nation that broke away from the British control, was the French Revolution. And out of that revolution, there was an individual that rose up into power and claimed himself to be the emperor, and that's Napoleon. And as he grasped that, he began on a conquest that ultimately was to be the ruler of the world. And slowly, prior to this date, nation after nation of Europe is falling to his advancing forces. And his sights next are on England. He is massing his troops on the coast across from the English Channel in preparation of invading England. Just prior to this, Spain has, through some battles and some force exerted, basically, though, has entered into an alliance by threat to join Napoleon and his forces. And as such, Napoleon has added to his navy a very strong, powerful, and experienced navy, that being the Spanish fleet. They've been in many battles. They had well-built ships. They had seasoned and experienced crewmen. And so it was a great asset to his desire to go into England and conquer it, because they'd have to cross the English Channel, and it wouldn't happen without ships of war and ships to be able to carry those troops. And so to kind of really understand what's going on as we consider this, with the French Revolution, it really was a trying to overthrow what they perceived as the wealthy and the upper level of society who was ruling over the masses. And so with the revolution, we find in the French Revolution that much of the wealthy individuals, those in power, positions of prestige, were either executed, they were exiled, or they fled. And that also applied to the French Navy. Most of the officers were well-to-do. They were paid well. They're very respected. They knew the people, political figures at the time. And as a result, most of them were gone. The only ones that really remained in the French Navy were those that swore their allegiance to Napoleon almost immediately. And most nations, including Spain, France, as well as England at this time, had what they called as pressed service. That means that if a captain of a ship needed somebody for a crewman and he saw you, he took you off the street, walking in front of your home, in a bar, wherever it might be. If he needed someone, he had complete authority just to take you and put you into service, in the service. And at this particular time, most of the French Navy was in that condition. They were what's referred to as pressed service. They had been compelled to serve there. And most of them, because after the Revolution and most of the prisons being opened up and stuff, the vast majority of the French Navy were formerly been prisoners who had been released and then pressed into service during the Revolution. Now, with these two navies, the Spanish and the French fleets combined together, and Napoleon's army amassing on the coast there off France, looking over the channel into England, England was well aware of what was coming. And so they'd started a blockade of the French and the Spanish ships, keeping them in port, putting the ships they had off just outside the ports, ready to engage them when they came out. And so as a result, the Spanish and the French fleets, both for quite a period of time, they're sitting in port. And as a result, these French individuals who had just been pressed in the service and never been on a ship before aren't getting a whole lot of experience. They're sitting in port, taking care of a ship. The Spanish Navy, on the other hand, had been in a lot of battles. They were very experienced. And at this particular time, they're very resentful of sailing with the French. Although their government had told them and given them orders to do that, for the most part, particularly the officers of the Spanish Navy are very resentful of that. They look at the French Navy as traitors. The officers are there, the ones that didn't stand firm and that they swore their allegiance to Napoleon. They look at them as traitors. They look at the crews as thieves and at best inexperienced. And in particular, have great resentment to French officers with little or no experience giving orders and making the decisions on what they're going to do. Those are kind of important things for us to understand when we compare this to the British Navy at the time. And in particular, one man. An individual that really, books and books have been written about him. He's still in the books of naval history. He's probably still considered one of the greatest naval officers in history. He commanded a loyalty from those that knew and served with him that's really hard to describe. You know, I've read many letters as I was preparing for this of officers and crewmen alike that served with him. And the respect and the honor they had for him is almost beyond ability to describe. He was a man of great character, honor, integrity, and loyalty, and he inspired those that were around him. He had great wisdom. In fact, as we look to tonight, he changed not only a navy, but a country, and really the history of the world. That individual is Admiral Horatio Nelson. Maybe you're familiar, those who like history or watch much of the History Channels or read books, probably isn't anything new. You've probably heard his name before. He was born September 29th, 1758. He joined the Royal Navy at age 12 and was captain of his own ship by age 20. As I said, most all navies, including the British Navy, had pressed service, which means, you know, they take someone, if they are in need of someone, they would take them wherever they could find them. If you're walking down the street along a port or along the many bars that were along the ports or wherever they would come in contact, if they needed you and you appeared to be able-bodied, they had complete authority to take you and put you into service. As a result, most of the crews in navies and the British Navy up to this point had really considered, the crew was really considered property, and they are very expendable. Captains at sea had complete control and authority over their crew. Conditions were harsh. The treatment generally is very cruel and the punishment severe. Captains having complete authority and put crewmen to death at their discretion if they felt that the circumstances warranted it. But Nelson, right from the start of his career, had a completely different philosophy. He considered the crew and its officers to be the greatest asset to a ship of war. He felt that there was absolutely no substitute for an experienced, healthy, and content crew. He generally would refuse prisoners for press service if they were brought to him by other officers unless he felt their crime was not one of a lack of moral character. Discipline, first as a young officer, then when he was a captain of his own ship, and it began to spread to eventually when he was the admiral, was drastically changed. He preferred extra duty or withholding of privileges rather than the severe floggings or beatings or even executions that were commonplace. Because he believed ultimately the crew was the greatest asset, and a crewman that's dead was of no value. One that is injured and unable to perform is of no value. One who, because he's been flogged so terribly that he has scar tissue and it's limited his ability to move and is handicapped from that time forward, was of no value. This particular time, you know, crews at sea for a long time, they suffered from lack of hygiene and poor food. Doctors at the time didn't really realize it, but without fresh fruit, they had all kinds of diseases, scurvy and many others that would come upon crews when they were at sea for a long time. Nelson didn't understand, you know, the biology of what's happening, but he was experienced enough to know and had become ill himself, knowing that poor food corresponded on a ship with poor moral conditions or morale and health. As such, he tried his best to ensure that when they took provisions, that they got the best possible food when they took provisions on. While frequently other captains would make sure that there was good food for themselves and their other officers, they'd have a budget for these purchases, and frequently they'd buy inferior food so they could save money because it's cheaper. That probably wasn't even good. It was already starting to be in pretty poor shape by the time they even purchased it, and it wouldn't last very long in a voyage. Nelson insisted very early on in his career that when he was in a position that the best possible provisions were bought. It's recorded at times that when he was a captain of his own ship, at times he paid out of his own wages when there wasn't enough for the best quality food to make sure that his ship started with the best food. Just a little bit of trivia there is that's kind of where the phrase came that we're familiar with is that British ships at that time, when they're at sea, things would be moving around all the time. And, you know, a round plate could turn and twist. And so their plates were square, and they had a little square section, a hole that they put in the table so it couldn't turn when they put their food down there. And so the phrase of a square meal, that's where that comes from, is because under Nelson it was very good. He had the best food he could get for his crew, and it became a square meal. And frequently the sailors, when they'd ask, you know, about the conditions, out there, they said frequently when they were on land, they'd go maybe 3 days without a meal, but in Nelson's army, they were guaranteed 3 squares a day. Nelson, unlike many others, always led in battle. He was always in the engagement. He was always on the first ship to engage the enemy in the battle of the Cape St. Vincent. He led the boarding party onto two different Spanish ships in hand-to-hand combat. He was wounded four times in battle, and he carried that evidence in the fact that his right arm was amputated from one incident, from a cannonball. And he's blind in his right eye from another incident, as well as being several other times injured in battle. He had a history of continuously being victorious in the battles he fought in. And yet he hated war and longed for peace. In all his writings, he always hoped that each battle would be the last one and he'd secure peace for his homeland of England. Most nations offered purses for enemy ships that their captains captured. In most cases, this went to the officers only. In rare cases where it was promised to the crew, they rarely received it. And then if they did, it was usually only a fraction of what they were promised. Nelson always ensured that every member of his crew received part of the prize money to the lowest member. The lowest one typically wasn't paid very much, but he generally made sure of the prize that most would get like a year and a half wages. He felt as a good morale booster. While many captains practiced very little with their cannons and their guns, they wanted all the ammunition they had for battles. Nelson believed in practice. He'd rather have less ammunition with a crew that could fire rapidly and accurately than have an abundance of ammunition and not be able to hit the target. Under his training and expectations, the British Navy under him grew to a standard that, can understand, these cannons were heavy. Some of them weighing anywhere from 1 up towards 2 tons. They are firing cannonballs in various sizes from 18 to 24 to 32, and the biggest one on the ship he was on in this battle was a 64-pound cannonball. With all the powder that goes in it, and when the cannon fired, they had to clean it out, get all the embers out from the previous thing. They had to put the powder in. They had to carry manually, load the thing. They are fired by, you know, putting powder in there, a primer, and a lot of different things, and then they had to move everything up. And he had a standard that his crews could regularly fire and maintain every 90 seconds. Many could do faster than that, but it's the standard he expected. As a result, he had a very experienced and loyal crew. Few left. He had few desertions. Even those that were pressed into service, when they had the opportunity, found life at sea preferable to their life at land. We typically tend to think of 19th century ship of war, a sailing ship, as kind of primitive, but they weren't. They were very complex with the rigging, the weapons, meals, repairs. And although not the largest ship that was in the Battle of Trafalgar, that privilege going to the Spanish Navy, Nelson's flagship, the HMS Victory, is preserved, so we have pictures to look at. It's been preserved, and so we have a lot of photographs here. Find that it was constructed on July 23rd, 1759. It was launched May 7th, 1765, and then commissioned in 1778. A long time. It took a lot of time to build these ships. Over 6,000 trees went into its construction. It weighed 3,500 tons without any crew or provisions on board. Carried 104 guns. You can see them in three rows along the side there. Had a crew of over 800. 27 miles of rigging. The sail area total over 5 acres of surface area. Everything here has to be moved by hand. All these ropes and cables and everything, they raise and lower the sails. They turn them in angles. They move everything on there. It's very complex. Without electricity and everything, but it was still a very complex operation. So now a little picture there, kind of get perspective on size with the buildings, the three-story buildings in the back, and see the size of this particular ship. And this isn't the largest one that fought in the battle. Finding a little bit of this is my little drawing here. This is supposed to be some ships. But the way they fought, if you look, all their guns are along the sides here, and they fire out, coming out the sides. They might have maybe one or two guns in the front, and maybe, you know, three or four to fire out the rear. And the fire off the side is called a broadside. And so the ideal situation for a captain to get a ship in is this one right down here. He can bring all his guns to fire with very little being returned. This one's going to be firing guns across here, and it can do the same thing going across the bow. That is the ideal situation to get in. You're bringing your maximum amount of guns to bear against their least amount. Also, the ships were the weakest in the bow and weakest in the stern. Their thickest wood was along the sides. Frequently, they could fire a cannonball, go through there, and go completely through the full length of the ship. To avoid this, they got in the habit of what's calling fighting in lines, that they would line themselves up like this. Whoops, go back one. They'd line themselves up, one navy going this way and the other. Sometimes they go the same direction, but they would line up one behind the other. So if they're protecting their bow and their sterns, and they're only bringing their guns and their most heavily armored sections to bear to the enemy. Problem with this, though, is typically the first ship here engages this ship and this ship and this ship. It keeps going down. If there's any length, typically the first, second, or third ships wouldn't survive it. They're basically considered to be expendable because they're going to have to run the whole length every time coming up against a fresh ship. And each time they're taking more and more damage. Ideally, what someone could do if they gave the opportunity is called breaking the line. If there was a big enough space, they'd try to turn across and get in that favorable position. And so in order to avoid this, what they would do is they would try to keep their ships absolutely as close as possible as they can. This ship would try to be as close as they could, not leave a space that the enemy can get in between them. From this idea that a little bit of more trivia, those of like history and any naval history in particular at all, there was called the ships that did this, the fighting ships, the heavily gunned ones with, 70, 80, 90, 100 cannon. The largest one in the Battle of Trafalgar was a Spanish ship. They had 130 cannon. They're called ships of the battle line. Got shortened out there to ship of the line, if you've heard that phrase. A ship of the line, that's what it means. The first-rate ships, the heavily armored, the heavily gunned that would fight. And then when they got to the point with mechanisms and steam that they didn't have to fight in a line, and then became battleships. And that's where the names have carried down from the days of sail. To look at our leaders that we have up to this point is Napoleon wanted to be in control. History records that. He wanted to be in control. And therefore, he didn't have a whole lot of confidence in the officer out there. He wanted to give the orders. He wanted to make the decisions. And that carried over to his naval officers. And as such, when they got in combat, no ship was to act without receiving orders from the commanding officer of the fleet at the time, whereas the admiral, if he's injured, it went down in rank. But no ship was to act independently. It had to wait for orders. Nelson knew from experience. He'd been in many battles. The French Revolution's been going on. In the past years, they've been in battles with Spain. They've previously been in battles with French ships as well as others. And Nelson knew from experience in battle. At this time, this is before televisions, and we don't have cell phones and things. Communication was by signal flags. They were slow to prepare because if it's a long message, we had all these flags and stuff. It took a long time to get the flags prepared. You're losing valuable time. Often they may never have been completed because the authority to give them might have been killed or wounded. They might not be seen because of the smoke from the battle, damage, or ships in between. Frequently only part of the ships would see it. Sometimes they would get the flags up and part of them would be torn away because of the damage from the flying cannonballs. And so he knew that when you went into battle, it caused a lot of problems. There were inaccurate messages. Only part of the fleet would receive it, and it caused great chaos. Therefore, Nelson went into battle with a completely different philosophy. Before, he had an incredible understanding of what his resources were, what the enemy was. And this is a time where, you don't have split-second reactions. I mean, things slow. Ships of sail travel slow. They would see one another be sailing for hours to get towards one another. They turn slow. And so really, it's not the person who can see and react the quickest, but the person who can anticipate and already be in the position and have the advantage. And so because of this, Nelson went into great detail with his battle plans with all the officers of his ship. Not just the captains, but the next down and several lines down, because he realized the captain might be wounded or killed. He had to have confidence that his chain of command would hold up. So he went into great details with his battle plans. He went over different possible scenarios so they all knew the objective. And when the battle came, he gave the final order to engage. Each captain was the captain of his own ship. He knew what was expected. He knew what the goal was. He knew some different scenarios of things happened, but he would not be waiting for a signal from Nelson. Nelson had been previously very successful in a lot of battles. He was very inventive in the way he went about things. They said for generations they'd fought as ships of the line for probably well over 100, maybe 200 years. Naval vessels had fought that way. They line up as close to one another as they can and go along and just start shooting at one another until someone gave up or there wasn't anything left. Previously, before Trafalgar, he had come up with a very inventive technique. Many believe that it was a precursor for the Battle of Trafalgar. Whether he intended that or not, it certainly had its advantages. Remember, Nelson always fought in the lead ship, and he didn't like to be expendable. He didn't like to be that ship that have to go down the full line of battle. And so what he did is they'd sail as a line, and then he'd break, in a previous battle, he'd break his fleet into two columns. And then they would go in, one column coming along here, engaging, the other one coming out there and going on the back. The first thing it did, it gets his ships, more ships, into the battle sooner. Each ship doesn't have to engage as many. But in particular, these ships are going to be inflicting damage as they come along that the falling ones have a chance of getting holes to get in there and do what they saw called breaking the line to do more damage. So as Nelson looked at Trafalgar, he's looking at a much larger naval force than he has. He knew that he is going to be greatly outnumbered. He is going to be greatly outgunned. And so Nelson had a plan for battle. Revolutionary. He was going to approach in two columns the Battle of Trafalgar. These are the Spanish and the French ships trying to sail out of port. The French are somewhat inexperienced, very inexperienced. They never got their ships in a line, as you can see. They're kind of haphazard all over the place. Nelson is going to come sailing in two columns like he's done before. But he tells his officers they're not going to turn. They're going to immediately break the line. They're just going to keep going straight through. That means, though, is that they're coming in, they essentially have no guns to fire. They're going to be getting broadsides from all these ships as they're approaching. As they're coming in, they're in the worst tactical position they can be in. But he's counting on the inexperience, particular of the French, that their rate of fire is going to be slow and it's going to be inaccurate. The Spanish, though more experienced, they've been harbored up in port, blockaded. So for a while, they haven't been too experienced either. They've had experience, but he's counting on their inexperience. They wouldn't turn. Each ship would begin to break the line. As they come through, or like here's a little bit closer, they wouldn't keep going through the same spot because these ships are going to keep moving. This one's going to break through here. This one's going to break through here. And by the time these ships get up here, these have moved up. And so they're each going to be going through, hopefully, in a different section. What immediately this does is it breaks the opponents into three sections of ships. Bearing in mind, these are days of sail. Things happen slow. So immediately, these ships are out of the battle. He's immediately reduced the number that he has to pose. It's going to take them a while to turn around and come back. His objective when he gave his officers, ideally, because he knows of the inexperience of the French, if there's any way you can, you break between two French ships. That's your ultimate thing. Second choice is to break between a French and a Spanish, and if at all possible, avoid going between two Spanish ships. At some point, this is going to become ship on ship. That's what he's counting on. He's counting on his experience and his training of his crew and their accuracy and their rate of fire to be able to overcome the opposing numbers. Nelson felt as he went into the battle that to ensure the British supremacy that he would have to at least capture or destroy 20 of the opposing fleet. As he went into battle, what he was facing is he has 27 ships, which carry 2,150 guns and 17,000 crewmen. The opposing fleet has 33 ships, 2,640, almost a 500-gun advantage, and over 30,000 troops. When the French-Spanish fleet came out of port, they did so because an American captain came in and told them that the British fleet wasn't out there and that Nelson was in England. And they came out in what was agonizing slow wind. And they came out of port and they're about to engage. Most of the ships were traveling a speed of 1 knot. That's about 1.5 miles an hour. And as anticipated, when they were approaching the enemy fleet, the French fire was very slow, it was very inaccurate. And to kind of understand it, this idea of accuracy, even though they're at close range, if you don't have experience, the ship is moving. The cannon's always going up, it's going down. And it's not like pulling a trigger on a gun. There was a delay between the time they lit it and went through the primer. And so not only did they have to do it, they had to anticipate how long it's going to take to fire. And if they're off, it went in the water or it went up and over. So, I mean, it's just not a matter of getting your sights. You're on a ship that's moving, and they have to time it. As Nelson's ships approached, they did so with remarkably light damage, even by Nelson. He expected to have a lot more. When he broke through that line, I said those lead ships, it broke 11 ships into the lead, which gave him immediately a 6-ship advantage. The British had been ordered that they were not to fire on any approach until they actually broke the line. And because the idea is to keep the ships as close together, they knew there was going to be a very close range. And so they were loaded what's called double shot, which doesn't go very far, but it's very devastating. That means they had a cannonball, and then in front of it's called grape shot, which is like a humongous shotgun. They're smaller, anywhere from 6 to 20, depending on the size of the cannon. And so when they'd fire it, that would spray like a humongous shotgun to take out crew members and sailing and rigging, and the cannonball falling behind to do damage to the ship. And when they first opened up, it's just unbelievable. You read the accounts. It's just the first ship, the British ship that engaged the first French ship, the first broadside, said it killed 400 crewmen, and took almost a third of their guns out of action. In the battle, the British fire was at a ratio of 3-1 compared to the French ships, and that's not even getting into the accuracy, and 2-1 for the Spanish ships. We found that the French ships were inexperienced. They were over-powdering their cannon. In other words, putting too much powder in it, that when they hit the British ship, it'd go completely through and hit French or Spanish ships on the other side. The British experience, they knew how much powder to use. They'd break through one side of the ship and just ricochet around, doing damage. And so while this battle is raging, these lead ships are continuing to sail away from the battle because they're waiting for their orders to return. It sounds crazy, but they were very specifically, they did not do anything until they received orders. So they're still sailing away, watching for that flag to tell them to come back. Finally, at some point, it's recorded supposedly that at some point a signal was sent, but none of the ships that are in the lead ever recorded having ever seen it, but they take it upon themselves to turn back. Destiny, if you will, or providence, as the lead ships began to turn around, the wind completely died. They're stuck out there. The ships are in battle. We're basically floating with the current. With the British ships, for the most part, being in a better advantage because of the way they approached the battle. Those lead ships have turned around. They actually sent large rowboats. They're not rowing their boats, but they're being powered by oars with ropes to begin towing their ships back into the battle. By the time those lead ships got back, the battle was over. One of the French ships tried to reach the French admiral's flagship, most likely to be the heroes to save the admiral and to get him out. When they arrived, they found that the flagship had already been captured. The admiral was already aboard an English ship. And then as it departed, it did something kind of strange, but had a lot of significance that would ripple through history, or at least the time immediately after. As it began to depart, it started firing. Bear in mind, this is the French ship, part of the French-Spanish fleet. It began firing on the Spanish ships. On board one of the captured Spanish ships, and when they capture it, you know, the British just send, you know, a small force just to occupy it. Not enough to really operate the ship, just enough to take control of it. And one of the Spanish ships was being fired on. The Spanish captain went to the British officer and gave him his word, "If you'll let my men man the cannons, we'll fire only on the French." And they did. You know, the battle was, you know, I'm not in great detail, but I mean, you know, the battles were brutal. You may think it's primitive, but these cannons did unbelievable damage. When they went through, the wood splintering from the hulls would do as much damage as the cannonball. You have masts that weigh tons falling down, rigging and sail falling down. They would fire cannonballs that are attached by chains. The idea was it'd rip apart the rigging from the ship. It'd also rip apart a man in the way. Grape shot, like I talked about, like a humongous shotgun. Imagine a shotgun, but firing, you know, pellets, you know, bigger than golf balls out. And then the cannonballs. In the battle, there wasn't time for a lot of neatness. The dead were tossed overboard. There wasn't a whole lot of great medicine, and the wounds usually were severe. Amputation was the only way really to stop bleeding from severely damaged limbs. They were tossed overboard. Accounts from sailors that survived talk about, you know, the blood flowing from the decks and down the side of the ships like water. The water red as blood, littered with bodies and body parts, debris from the ships. In the battle, Admiral Nelson was wounded. He wouldn't survive the battle. But he would live long enough to realize that his fleet had been victorious and to be able to give his final order to the fleet. And that final order would save many lives, British, French, and Spanish. You know, Nelson had inspired a great sense of honor as men. And part of that was, as noble as it was to be as solid and hard and fearless as you could be in battle, is every grade of disgrace to assault or wound someone who's defenseless. The amazing thing, after this bloody, brutal battle, the British went to great lengths at risk of their own lives and loss of British lives to save the Spanish and French from their fleet, from ships that were burning, from injuries. In one particular case during the battle, you know, this seems, we hear such horror stories of modern warfare and just the hatred that goes with it. It's a different time. It's hard to understand. In one case, there was a British ship that thought a Spanish ship was signaling that it was surrendering. And so they sent a ship with an officer and some crewmen over to occupy it. And it was a misunderstanding. But the Spanish wouldn't fire on these individuals coming over, and they boarded. They explained why they're there. The Spanish said no, they weren't. The British apologized for misunderstanding the message. The Spanish apologized for taking those officers out of the battle and sent them back to their ship. Nelson was advised, you know, that the battle was over and that the surviving combined fleet was withdrawing. And that they had captured or destroyed 14 ships. The crew knew well that Nelson wanted 20 ships, and they were willing to go after them. Ships badly damaged. They were willing to do whatever it took to follow after those fleeing ships to give Nelson those six extra ships he needed. But to their surprise, Nelson was wounded, dying. As such, he's down inside the ship with the surgeon. No windows. Dank, dark, just a candle full of smoke from the cannons. No window or sight of what's going on outside, and yet he ordered his fleet to find a port and anchor. Well, after his death, the officers considered, you know, making their own... Admiral's now dead. It's now the next ranking officer to make the decision. And they could go after the fleet that was leaving. But their such respect was they would honor his last order. And so they began making preparations to head for harbor. With their ships badly damaged, the French and Spanish ships are badly damaged, towing the ones that are completely dismasted with no sails, agonizingly slow, no wind to speak of. That decision saved many lives because within 24 hours they're in the middle of a hurricane. That hurricane sank more of the damaged French and Spanish ships that were fleeing that hadn't been captured. More that continued to flee encountered other British ships that were coming to join the battle that hadn't got there yet, which two more were sunk. Until the final outcome was the British fleet, no ships lost or captured. 449 dead, 1,241 wounded. French-Spanish fleet, 21 ships lost or captured. 4,395 dead, 2,541. And most historians say it was probably greater because particularly the French, they didn't like the idea they'd lost, and they probably didn't account a lot of the people around. A lot of them were press service. Some of them there weren't records for. Some they didn't even know were on board the ships. They would just grab them. There might not even be any records. So this is just what was acknowledged. Most historians think the Spanish records, this is them combined, the Spanish records are probably pretty accurate, but the French, the total devastation from their inexperience is probably even greater. During the hurricane, once again, the British efforts were hard to describe, trying to save individuals on those damaged ships that were in tow. They were beginning to sink. British lives were lost trying to save French and Spanish sailors that were aboard their ships to get them onto British ships in the middle of a hurricane. When they arrived for their port, initially the prisoners were treated very well. They were given on their word of honor, basically free roam, and they were provided food and shelter until an exchange could be made for British prisoners for them. However, some of the French didn't take advantage of that, and despite giving their word, they didn't, so they found themselves treated as prisoners. They were locked up. Not a single member of the Spanish fleet did that. They gave their word, they'd remain, and they were treated quite well. I put these points in because these are very important what happens in history. The Spanish didn't like the French very much to start with, and they absolutely loathed the fact that French ship fired on the Spanish ships as they left. And they admired the honor and integrity that the British sailors had. They admired the risks that they went to save their crew and to treat them well. As a result, there were many Spanish officers that after that battle vowed that his ships would never fire on a British ship again. Though Napoleon would give orders, bear in mind the Spanish had a very, very impressive fleet, very experienced. The ships that were damaged were remarkably very slow to be repaired. The ships were being built, were very slow to be completed. Orders were lost and misunderstood. And very shortly after that, Spain would withdraw from its alliance with Napoleon. Eventually, Napoleon would be defeated by Britain at the Battle of Waterloo. But really, by all historians' accounts, his expansion and Napoleon's expansion and dream of world dominance ended at the Battle of Trafalgar. It would be many years of battles and things. From that point, though, he was no longer a mode of expansion. He was losing ground. Roy Atkins, in his book, Nelson's Trafalgar, The Battle That Changed the World, writes this: "One of the most important elements of the victory at Trafalgar was that the subsequent development of the British naval supremacy allowed the growth of the empire. Even if Napoleon had not invaded Britain, a defeat at Trafalgar might have just led to naval supremacy for France. It was British sea power that transported Wellington's army to invade Spain and also kept that army supplied. Without the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, there might not have been a Battle of Waterloo 10 years later. Perhaps more importantly, one of Napoleon's aims was to expand France's trade by increasing the number of its colonies. And with French naval supremacy, he would have undoubtedly have tried to extend his empire beyond Europe. If it had grown as large as the British Empire, French would probably be the dominant world language by now. Instead, the British Empire expanded to encompass a quarter of the world's land surface, becoming the biggest empire ever seen, with English as the most widespread language in the world. An event in history took about 6 hours, the actual battle. But what it did in the course of world events, I believe, is very significant. Most historians look at this as a world-changing event in history. And I believe if we look at it and we go into this thought to look if, in fact, the British people and the English-speaking nations are of Ephraim, then some of those prophecies we should find to fit. And so now I'm going to take a little time to kind of look at that. You know, Ephraim was the youngest of Joseph's two sons. You find that he obtains the blessing from Jacob. It would be Israel. It's not by name Jacob. His name would change to Israel. You have to keep up with these people. They always change the names in the Bible to confuse us. But Joseph brought his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, before Jacob, or Israel, his father. And he had them placed right that Manasseh, the eldest, would receive the birthright of the eldest. But his father crossed his hands and did it the other way. And as Joseph brings it to his father's attention that he's doing it backwards, it picks up here in Genesis 48:18. And Joseph said unto his father, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put thy right hand upon his head." And his father refused and said, "I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he. And his seed shall become a multitude of nations." And he blessed them that day, saying, "In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. As I've looked through this, I'm going to just kind of point out some things. I obviously don't have time to go in great detail, but as I've looked at this, I'm convinced that Ephraim received the birthright, not just through Joseph, because this comes from Jacob. I believe that Ephraim received the birthright of Israel. If we consider that idea, consider that when the conquest of Canaan, that Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim. It says, "These are the names of the men which Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua," which is going to be Joshua the way we say it today. "And of the tribe of Ephraim, Hosea, the son of Nun." Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim. We find that the tabernacle, when it was first set up, it says, "And the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle and the congregation there, and the land was subdued before them." Shiloh was in the land that was allocated to Ephraim. Find it after their first exile. And the people are starting to return back into the land, that it tells us that, "And in Jerusalem dwelt the children of Judah and of the children of Benjamin and of the children of Ephraim and Manasseh." That's 1 Chronicles 9:3. And so we find that Jerusalem is just slightly outside of the boundaries for the land from Ephraim, Judah being directly to the south where Jerusalem is at. But after their first exile and return, much of Ephraim actually went into Jerusalem. It was there that the temple was then set up. We find, as we continue through, that the northern kingdom, the kingdom would divide, and we look at the reasons that the revolts and everything that came, but nonetheless, it was prophesied that God would cause that to occur. Jeroboam was from the tribe of Ephraim. We read that in 1 Kings 11:26, and he became the king of the northern kingdom, and the 10 tribes were allocated to it. And this was told by the Lord through the prophet Ahijah, saying that he would give 10 tribes of Jeroboam to be king over the northern kingdom due to Solomon's transgressions, but he would leave 2 tribes there, being Judah and Benjamin, to keep the promise that he had given to David. But because of Solomon's transgressions, he was removing the rest out and giving them under rule of Jeroboam, who was from the tribe of Ephraim. We look at there the blessing that comes upon Joseph. We're very familiar with this, as Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him, but his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, even by the God of thy father, who shall help thee, and by the Almighty, who shall bless thee with the blessings of heaven above. Blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. We read this, you know, it says it's upon Joseph. It doesn't specify which son. We, because we believe in the Book of Mormon, we see Manasseh fulfilling that. We look at this, it says, whose branches run over the wall. We look at this barrier, the wall, the ocean. And that, in fact, those that came over, that we have the recorded record in the Book of Mormon, fulfill that, being of Manasseh. However, it isn't specifically aimed at Manasseh, says Joseph. And so I'd like us to consider tonight that if, in fact, the British people, the English-speaking, are of Ephraim, if not, in fact, them coming over and forming this nation, the United States, isn't also a fulfillment of that. In consideration of that, let's look at Ephraim and Manasseh. When they first went into the land and they were given the boundaries, Manasseh and Ephraim both expanded immediately beyond what they were given. It says, and the children of Joseph spoke unto Joshua. He's just set out the boundaries of their land for him, saying, why hast thou given me but one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing I am a great people? For as much as the Lord hath blessed me hitherto. And Joshua answered them, if thou be a great people, then get thee up to the wood country and cut down for thyself there in the land of the Perizzites and out of the giants. If Mount Ephraim be too narrow for thee. And the children of Joseph said, the hill is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites that dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron. But they who are of Bethshean and her towns, and they who are of the valley of Jezreel. And Joshua spoke unto the house of Joseph, even to Ephraim and to Manasseh, saying, thou art a great people and hast great power. Thou shalt not have one lot only, but the mountain shall be thine. For it is a wood, and thou shalt cut it down, and the outgoings of it shall be thine. For thou shalt drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong. Right from the beginning, Manasseh and Ephraim both began expanding beyond what they originally were allocated by Joshua. And so I have to consider if that is, in fact, you know, a type, an indication of something that we can expect, that not only through Manasseh, but through Ephraim, we can find these things. Early in the history of Israel, the kingdom broke between Judah and Ephraim. I talked about that Jeroboam being set up, and it became a division between them early on. We're studying that in Isaiah now, the 7th chapter. It says, because Syria and Ephraim and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. Ephraim vexing Judah. You know, both England and the United States for a long time were very hostile to Jews. They put limitations to coming into the country. They weren't treated very well until after World War II. Isaiah, perhaps looking forward to the day, says, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt, from Pathrus and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up for an ensign for the nations, and he shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. That's Isaiah 11:11-13. Are we perhaps seeing that? We're now that
That division that's divided the kingdom of Israel is now being healed.
The relationship between if and fact that Britain, the United States, are of the tribe of Ephraim. And our, as we see in history, we're going closer to our relationships with Israel. You know, consider what Ezekiel says. Talking about a familiar thing about the stick of Joseph. Saying to them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim and the tribes of Israel, his fellows, and I will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand. We frequently use this, and you've probably heard it many times, to talk about, you know, the Book of Mormon. A record of Joseph. In the hands of Ephraim, our brother Gordon did a study a while back about the choice seer. And we consider that possibility, the fact that Joseph Smith was of the tribe of Ephraim. Many of the original founding fathers and stuff, and that would be fulfillment of this prophecy. I personally, when I look at this, I think it means even more than that, but that'd be another study. But I think it certainly includes that. And I think if you look at Ezekiel and you read some of the previous and the following verses, that it applies even more than just this written record we have here. But so I'd like us to consider some of these things. And in fact, if in fact we look that England might in fact be the tribe of Ephraim and the early founding fathers of our nation might have been the tribe of Ephraim, how does that fit? Where Brother Don McIndoe did a study on Revelation. And he identified in that study that the first beast was the Roman Empire. The second beast he identified as the Holy Roman Empire, which is a little bit different. The Roman Empire being more a military thing, but then with the rise of the Catholic Church and the papal powers and the combining of those, it set up a new thing referred to as the Holy Roman Empire because of the religious association. So if we consider that, and we consider that if in fact Ephraim does have the birthright of Israel, if we consider the fact, you know, the way things go, the first shall be last, the last shall be first, and it was with Ephraim breaking away, can we look at Ephraim to be where it starts to bring back the restoration of the house of Israel? England was the first nation to break from the Roman Catholic Church in 1534 of its hold that it had around Europe. It was under King Henry VIII. For the wrong reasons, the Catholic Church wouldn't grant the king a divorce, and so he formed his own church, the Church of England. But nonetheless, it began a break there from the Roman Catholic Church. We find that same time frame starts the Reformation, those early founders who saw the wrongs in the Catholic Church and a desire to change it. And from those same individuals came the English Bible. From there, the Puritans that began traveling to our nation for religious freedom. And interestingly enough there, with that, there comes the end of the second beast. My brother Don, in his series, The Revelation of Jesus Christ to the Apostle John, section 12 in the October 2002 Zion's Advocate says, and remember, this battle was October 21st, 1805, and Sheldon and B. McIndoe, Brother Brian sitting back there, as do most historicists, relate this second beast to papal Rome. They visualize the horns as symbolizing the civil and the ecclesiastical power of the apostate Roman Church. Sheldon goes farther to state that the intention of the second beast was the implementation of the papal will by the sword and was fulfilled by Frankish kings, and those are the forerunners for France, of Europe, in support of the papacy. King Charlemagne of France withdrew the Lombard kings in Italy in AD 774 and gave unlimited support and power to the Pope. He then began a 30-year conquest to conquer and Christianize Western and Central Europe. On Christmas Day in AD 800, he knelt before an altar, and Pope Leo III then placed a crown upon his head, and the people assembled in the church acclaimed him the great Pacific Emperor of the Romans. The civil, military, and ecclesiastical papacy combination gave rise to the Holy Roman Empire, which existed from AD 800 to 1806. Our brother McIndoe goes further, describing in Revelations this great sore. And this is from section 16 in the March 2003 Zion's Advocate. Albert Barnes is typical of most historicists in believing that the purpose of these last plagues is to weaken and finally destroy the power of the papacy. He writes, in an important sense,
France has always been the head of the papal power. The King of France has been usually styled by the popes themselves, the eldest son of the church. In reference to the whole papal dominion, in former times, one of the principal reliances has been on France, and to a very large extent, the state of Europe has been determined by the condition of France. It is for this reason that many historicists believe that the noisiest and grievous sore which fell upon men was representative of the French Revolution beginning in 1789, lasting until the dawn of the 19th century. Indeed, the power of the Catholic Church was greatly restricted, and its clergy suffered disproportionate losses in the Reign of Terror that took 40,000 lives. Gregg writes, in the French Revolution, a foul and loathsome sore, that is, the moral corruption, atheism, and general dissolution of society spread over those countries where the beast and its image were principally worshipped. You know, Zechariah looks ahead to a time when God's beginning to recover his people, to reestablish Israel. And he saw Ephraim as a mighty man, the title I started tonight. It says, "And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them. For I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am the Lord their God, and I will hear them. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it and be glad. Their heart shall rejoice in the Lord. I will hiss for them, and I will gather them, for I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased. And I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again." Our brother Brian McIndoe, some time ago, quite a few years ago, he gave a sermon. I believe it's a sermon, not a study. And in that, he talked about when the gospel first came out, when the Lord first appeared and took upon flesh, and the significance of it during the Roman Empire. At that time, that was the largest empire that had existed as far as dominion that it covered and the most common language. It allowed the gospel to go out like it did. It allowed what we read the epistles of Paul and the others as they traveled to go under this control that was there of the Roman Empire this time and have a common language that the gospel would go forth like it never would have before in history, just because there have been barriers of countries and languages. At that time, it was the greatest dominion in language. And yet, following this battle that coincides where our brother Don puts as far as the end of the power of the second beast and the Holy Roman Empire, the rise of the British Empire grew to be larger than the Roman Empire, more far-reaching, and with a common language. The foreground for the restoration. A time where there would be a time where the greatest number of people would be the most unified with the ability to travel and speak a common language. Jeremiah describes Ephraim, says to the Lord, Ephraim was a dear child. He says, "I have heard surely Ephraim bemoaning himself thus, Thou hast chastened me, and I was chastened as a bullock, unaccustomed to the yoke. Turn thou me, and I shall be turned, for thou art the Lord my God. Surely after I was turned, I repented, and after that I was instructed. I smote upon my thigh, I was ashamed, yea, even confounded, because I did not hear the reproach of my youth. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he a pleasant child? For since I spake unto him, I do earnestly remember him still. Therefore my bowels are troubled for him. I will surely have mercy upon him, saith the Lord." As I look at these things, you know, I don't think that is a coincidence that Ephraim, in the role of England and then the United States, ends the power of the second beast. Others would rise up until World War I. You have to bear in mind, sometimes we talk about Israel as this little nation surrounded. Well, England is a little island. Small compared to all the other European countries. It's a little island. And when it rose up after this battle and grew to prominence, it many times has stood against the world. In World War I, the powers of Europe, this little island would stand against until the United States joined in. Very late in the war, we came in very late in World War I. For a long time, England stood alone. I don't find it a coincidence that because that happened, that about 20 years later, now two powers would rise up. One in Asia, one in Germany. One focused upon this little island and the other focused upon the United States. That really in World War II, the United States and Britain stood against the world. Then that having failed, we find that Judah, their brother, is born. Israel becomes a nation. And we find the rise of these world powers suddenly turning against that. Failing to defeat that, we now find that those powers once again are turning back on the United States and Britain. And with that, I see the United States and Britain and Israel becoming closer and closer, and I think that will continue. Since September 11th, there's an alliance that many are not aware of. Our intelligence community, we were not, as the United States, we were not prepared for something like that. Israel knew what was going on, and so because of need, became a close relationship there for information to get us jump-started. England had long been dealing with terrorists for 40 years with the IRA. A lot of expertise in how to handle these things. So I don't find it a coincidence that these powers keep rising up and they keep aiming at these different things, but it always comes back to the same. I believe Hosea was a prophet that spoke of Ephraim more than any other. If you get up your concordance and you look up Ephraim, a lot in the first books of the Old Testament, you find a lot of the word Ephraim, but it's where they're doing things. Ephraim went here and did that, recording what happened. But if you look for the prophecies, I think Hosea prophesies more about Ephraim than any other. But you go through those chapters, starting about the fifth chapter, I mean, mostly it's about the things that Ephraim's doing wrong and the consequences that are come from it. Over and over. Just like we read here in Jeremiah where the Lord's looking about, you know, that Ephraim has done many things wrong. And yet at some point, Ephraim's going to say, recognize the things that he did in his youth. And I believe Hosea, looking at a time when Israel's going to be regathered and the Lord is setting his hand to accomplish that, he says this in the closing chapters. 14th chapter of Hosea. Ephraim shall say, What have I to do anymore with idols? If in fact, you know, we really, maybe many in this room are of the tribe of Ephraim, we probably have more idols than any other nation. Our abundance, our easy lifestyle, if there's anyone who has idols to put away, it would be we. What have I to do anymore with idols? I have heard him and observed him. I am like a green fir tree. From me is thy fruit found, who is wise, and he shall understand these things. Prudent, he shall know them. For the ways of the, and this is what Ephraim is going to say, for the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, but the transgressors shall fall therein. Find it interesting that Hosea writes this, and our brother McAdoo in his thing on Revelation writes this. In Zion's Advocate, January 2003, Apostle Sheldon sees these opening verses as a revelation of a future event. He foresees a literal number of 144,000 of Israel that will be sealed to God, 12,000 from each tribe. He assumes this will also include Ephraimite Gentiles who have become Israel through adoption, Ephesians 1:5. Since they have not been defiled by the corrupt doctrines of men, they have qualified themselves as virgins and thus would be the saints of God. What I want to try to emphasize tonight, because I'm bringing this point with a concern, and I do not, my intent tonight is not in any way to minimize the importance of the promises that we have to Manasseh. But if you've been in the church for any length of time, you've heard them, and you should be familiar with them, and you will hear them again. But Scripture also gives Ephraim a very important role. And as I look at these things, where my concern comes in is, you know, Satan has a way of finding things that work, and then if he has to tweak it a little bit to use something else, in a different group of people he wills. And I find frequently things that don't that work well in the world, he just changes it a little bit and finds it works well in the body of Christ. Today there's a philosophy in the world about the rapture. Probably anyone that's been here any length of time, you've heard our discussions and our studies and the falsehood of that. But really what it comes down to is, as our brother McIndoo did this store or this study on Revelation, shows that this has been going on for a long period of time. And if I remember correctly, he puts us probably somewhere around the 16th chapter. And I'm just guessing off the top of my head. If I remember, he puts us about the 16th chapter of Revelation somewhere in there. That everything before that, he can show has happened somewhere in history. The rest of the world that doesn't, they're looking for all this stuff to happen somewhere down the road. They're just waiting, you know, sometime this is going to happen. They're missing all the things that they should be seeing. Remember, our Lord said, you know, about the fig tree. You watch these things because when you see the leaves coming out, you see the fruit, these are signs of what's going to happen. And I have to kind of wonder if maybe the same thing doesn't happen with us, because when I look at these things and I look at the promises and I look at those things that we expect from Manasseh, they're important, but they're towards the end. And if we put our focus wholly upon that, we're much like those that believe in the rapture, that we start looking for something that's going to happen somewhere down in the future, and we miss what's happening right now. The promises to Manasseh are very, very important. So I do not want anyone to think here, I'm trying to say, Ephraim is more important. That is not my point. But as I consider this, there, as we've done several studies in the past, and we've contemplated it, we cannot prove it, but there is some pretty compelling evidence that probably the English-speaking nations of the world, Britain and then the United States, were of the tribe of Ephraim. Considering that, I take that and I place it into the prophecies that I see for Ephraim, and it seems to fit. That convinces me that probably more than likely, if not necessarily in whole, because the Scripture tells us that Ephraim is going to be mixed among the nations. But in the eyes of the Lord, there's Ephraim, and he has been working with the tribe that I believe carries the birthright of Israel to bring Israel back into existence, and it started hundreds of years ago. It set the foundation for the restoration. It set the foundation, was a strength for Israel to become a nation. And if we miss that, we miss the opportunity to be excited about what God is doing right now and today. If we're always waiting for something that's going to happen with Manasseh, I think we miss the excitement. And I say excitement. Excitement sometimes in fulfillment of biblical prophecy comes in very trying times. I stood here and told you about a horrible battle, that many lives were lost. And I see it a turning, history sees it as a turning time in history. And I believe we look at prophecy, it was the consequences of the changes were prophesied of. But a lot of men lost their lives. September 11th changed the world and our nation. And it can be a scary time. We're in wars. There's people that are concerned about that. Should we or shouldn't we be in Iraq? You know, lives are being lost. And yet I see biblical prophecy being fulfilled. And I rejoice. And I look at these things that are, they are not happenstance events, I don't believe. The more I look at this, it strengthens me and encourages me to see the Lord has been working for hundreds of years to bring us to where we're at. And so I hope tonight maybe this gives, my intent was just to take, sometimes we talk about, you know, this battle happened. And so I want to take a little more time to show, first off, that what we find recorded in a simple verse of Scripture can encompass so much. The Battle of Trafalgar really came down to one man. I mean, it happened really, I believe he's inspired of the Lord, but I've read many of his letters. And he believed wholeheartedly that he was directed to accomplish that battle. He believed that was his reason for being there. He knew that he wouldn't survive it. Just before the battle, he called his closest officers in and told them that, told them goodbye because he knew he wouldn't see any more because he was going to accomplish that that he'd been set here to do. And that he could go to his resting ground knowing that he had, in one of his letters, that he had accomplished what God had called him to do. And he had served God, king, and country. And the world changed because of that. France, the Holy Roman Empire, and it opened the door for the restoration 25 years later. And an empire that was growing that would allow English to be the language, it would allow the world to be in a condition they could go forward, just like when Christ came and the Roman Empire was there. And it allowed Paul and the others to go, as our brothers now today, go out. Maybe some of our brothers today are Ephraim, going to the lost tribes. Ephraim had the responsibility for the 10 tribes assigned in the northern kingdom. And so I just find it very interesting, and I don't have all the answers. If anyone has a question or something, I don't have all the answers, but I'm going to try to keep this kind of formal. If there's a question or a comment, that's about all I have to give tonight. And if not, let's go ahead and close.